Hello, Dimitri?
Yes, hello.
Hey, wow, we got you. Where are you?
I'm in Kalamata, Greece at the moment.
And, well, I had you in Turkey. What is, why are you there? What's going on with the Freedom Flotilla? And what are some of the issues you're dealing with? Why, first of all, why are you doing it at all?
Well, I'm doing it because there are 2.3 million people starving to death in Gaza, or on the verge of starving to death, and our government is shamefully and profoundly complicit in the crisis confronting them. And I feel, as a citizen in whose name this government purports to speak, to do whatever I can to draw the world's attention to this crisis and hopefully to deliver some humanitarian aid to these people.
Yeah,
it's as simple as that.
Yeah, you know, the Freedom Flotilla really has made its mark over the years, but this is an exceptional situation. Tell us, what are the plans? And you're taking humanitarian aid. What's your destination?
Well, there. I'll tell you what the plans were. At the moment, the plan is in flux. The plan was that there are three vessels carrying collectively over 5,000 tons of humanitarian aid docked in Istanbul. And they originally were scheduled to leave on the 21st of August directly for Gaza, heading down the Aegean coast of Turkey and then into the Eastern Mediterranean, and then across to Gaza, not to Israel, not to Israel's territorial waters, but to the waters of Gaza. And they were going to be carrying, in addition to all of that humanitarian aid, hundreds of human rights activists from around the world.
Yeah.
Many from the West, and a significant number from Canada. And then it was delayed until the 24th from the 21st because of information being demanded by the Turkish government. Then, because of further demands made by the Turkish government, it was delayed till the 24th, or the 25th, I should say, which was Thursday of last week. And then we were set to go on the 26th. We had received assurances from the Turkish government that the activists would be permitted to board the vessels on that day, Friday of last week. And on the day before, the Israeli government made a demand to the government of Guinea-Bissau, whose flag is borne by two of those three vessels, that it withdraw its flag. This precipitated an inspection by officials of Guinea-Bissau, or representatives of Guinea-Bissau. And without having found anything wrong with the vessels whatsoever, on the following day, the 26th, the government of Guinea-Bissau demanded that the organizers give written assurances that they would not travel to Gaza, or that the receiving port explicit written confirmation that it was authorized, that we were authorized to deliver the aid to Gaza. The problem is there is no receiving port.
Yes.
Gaza has no port. Correct. It says just precisely. So it was just a way of them saying, we're not going to allow you to go with without coming up with even offering any kind of a justification for this action, which frankly is a flagrant violation of Guinea-Bissau's obligations under Article 1 of the Genocide Convention.
The Sharmeen Narwani, who writes very smartly about these matters, she said, how about some of you BRICS countries? Is there a possibility another country could provide the flagship?
Well, I'm not one of the organizers of it. My understanding is from the organizers that that's precisely what they're trying to do. They're trying to find an alternative country that is willing to flag the vessels. Switching the flag of the vessels is not something, however, that can be done overnight. So, typically this takes some time, and it could be many days or weeks before this happens. You know, I think we're all reasonably confident that eventually the boats will depart. The problem is that people are dying Every day that aid is delayed.
Yes. I want to ask you about some of your comments on things. And by the way, we should note, I mean, you interviewed the grandson of Nelson Mandela. We should bring this name in. That's a highly significant presence for this Freedom Flotilla effort.
It certainly is. And, you know, Chief Mandela, who gave that interview, has actually been in Istanbul. He was there for the entire week. He addressed the activists on several occasions. He met with dignitaries. He has been eloquently demanding that the authorities permit us to depart. And he talked at great length about the efforts that he and other members of the South African Parliament and South African civil society have made, not only to ensure that South Africa's government pursued a case against Israel at the International Court of Justice, but that it also take a variety of other measures, for example, prosecuting criminally South Africans who also happen to be Israeli citizens and who are serving in the Israeli military. And there's a whole range of things which he said the South African government can do, but that it is not yet doing. But by the standards of our government and other Western governments, what South Africa's government has done this far is...
Oh, my goodness, they went to the International Court.
Absolutely. Under intense pressure not to do that. So, it's hardly lies in the mouth of a Westerner to criticize the government of South Africa.
Yes, hardly. I mean, actually, they're such a great example. We're speaking to Dimitri Lascaris. We're very glad we're getting the time to we can do that. It's a dramatic moment, really worldwide. I notice, and people should go to your Twitter account, follow what you're saying. I notice you're right on top of the story that Jill Stein was arrested in the United States and even beaten up, basically. Thank you for speaking out. Talk about that. I mean, she's been absolutely exemplary, and she's been endorsed by some powerful people now.
Yes, Dr. Jeffrey Sachs just gave a ringing endorsement of Dr. Stein in an opinion piece he offered about the forthcoming presidential election. He said that she's the strongest candidate for peace, and I wholeheartedly agree. As a matter of fact, I and some other Canadians have been working on her presidential campaign and assisting with putting together a platform. Mm-hmm. Jill Stein is the only, I mean, of course, Cornel West is a true anti-imperialist, and he certainly is a passionate voice for peace. But of all the candidates who stand a realistic chance of having their name put on the ballot in all or essentially all of the states in the United States, which is quite a challenge, by the way,
absolutely.
She is by far best. She's by, you know, Robert Kennedy Jr., who probably will get his name on most, if not all, of the ballots. He, you know, has been a shameless supporter of Israel's genocidal regime throughout this this appalling rampage in Gaza. So he certainly isn't a candidate for peace, despite his position on other issues involving international conflict. She's the only one who, across the board, is, you know, being true to the cause of peace. And I hope that Americans come to understand that they actually do have an alternative to Joe Biden, Genocide Joe, and Donald Trump. And that alternative is Jill Stein.
Yeah. No, it's just, it's quite phenomenal. And I'm glad you point this out. That, you know, she's built an organization. She really deserves a lot of credit at establishing a platform where people can run. Because, as you know, I mean, and you've outlined it, the major parties are work overtime to keep the Green Party off the ballot. But they, over the years, have established places where they can get their name on the ballot, and she's the one who did it. I thought she should be the perennial candidate. She's the best one.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, she actually was happy when announced that he was going to be or seek the nomination of the Green Party.
Yes.
You know, I think she thought that he had the attributes
necessary. She was too modest
to carry the banner of the party forward. Yes, although you know, I'm a fan of Dr. West in many ways, I was saddened to learn that she wasn't going to run. And she only did it when he, for inexplicable reasons, decided to run independently of any party. And it's inexplicable because he effectively has ensured that he's not going to get his name on the ballot in many states.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, including people who had formerly supported him, said that he pulled this move. The fact that he did this suggested that in reality he wasn't serious about presenting himself as a presidential candidate. So I don't know whether that's true or not, but
mm-hmm.
at the end of the day, she did the right thing. She stepped forward. She's throwing her hat into the ring again, and they are going to do everything possible, as I'm sure you know.
Well, going to Washington, I started to say George Washington, going to Washington University in St. Louis, you know, she's not a flamboyant person. She's very careful with her language, which is something I've always admired about her. But she's not afraid to show up. She said she was invited to Washington University because the students wanted to see some support from, you know, outside forces, political voices. And so she put herself on the line at the request of the students. And by the way, here you have these arguments about anti-Semitism. Jill Stein is Jewish. And she took the brunt of the police sweep. She was standing with her arms joined with others, and these very heavy policemen showed that they could beat up Jill Stein. What a disgrace.
Yeah, but they even roughed up and arrested a reporter from Fox News, a cameraman from Fox News. I think this was at the university in Texas.
A little irony.
So no one at the moment is safe from the brutality of the police. I mean, it's quite alarming. To me, this looks a lot like fascism.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know what else to call it.
When it happens, it is fascism. I mean, whether, you know, there's theory behind it. There's something about American police. I think it might have been you. I read so many tweets, but somebody pointed out that it was Jill Stein. She says they have a riot squad to create riots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They'll do anything to create a pretext for this kind of brutality at this stage. And it's what should be truly alarming to the public in the West is that this is being urged upon the police by supporters of Israel. Mm-hmm. Effectively, the supporters of Israel, it seems to me, are trying to create a political environment within Western countries, including the United States, that looks suspiciously similar to the one prevailing in Israel itself.
Well, it was the prime minister himself who said it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, Netanyahu was, you know, they prattle on in the United States about foreign interference in domestic politics of the United States. Netanyahu took to the air to basically urge American police to brutalize and silence these protesters. If that's not an interference in the domestic politics of the United States, I don't know what is.
Yes.
But certainly we are beginning to look a lot like Israel, more by the day, at the behest of people who support Israel.
Mm-hmm. Now, and to speak about that, by the way, you will be, I guess you're going to be in a kind of logistical dilemma. I've heard that you will be talking across the country sometime soon. I mean, of course, you will have to make your appointment for the flotilla. Mm-hmm. But what are you telling the Canadian public? What should they be saying about the current government and the political environment in Canada on this?
Well, look, I think this has become a simple matter of conscience at this moment, and it's not. It has gone beyond the interests of the Palestinian people. There is, in my view, Phil, a global struggle against fascism that is unfolding before our very eyes. The Palestinian people are on the front line of that struggle. And of all the people in the world who are engaged against fascism, in some kind of resistance to the forces of fascism, they are suffering the most, but this is something that impacts us all.
Mm-hmm.
And if we allow this to be done, this is not just an Israeli genocide. This is first and foremost a Western genocide with the United States leading the charge. Israel could never get away with this if it wasn't for the support of Western states and the munitions of the United States, Britain, and Germany. We are all at risk here. And if we allow this to be done with impunity to the Israelis, we are next. No one should have any illusions about that. Our freedom, our security, our prosperity is at risk.
Mm-hmm.
I personally find the suffering of the Palestinian people to be a sufficient reason to put myself at risk. But if that in of itself is not sufficient for the people listening to our conversation, consider where this will go if we allow this to be done with impunity.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, we had this episode, which we all watched it unfold, where the Israelis gave themselves the authority outside international law to attack an embassy of Iran looking to provoke something ugly. And Canada, to my knowledge, did not condemn that.
Yeah, and you know, the reason why we originally, the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network asked me to do this national speaking tour, which was going to start on May 14th in Toronto, and will be in Montreal, Winnipeg, Regina, Victoria, Ottawa, and other cities, was not because of the flotilla. I was presented with the opportunity to participate in the Freedom Flotilla after the decision was made to mount this national speaking tour. The reason why we did it was because I took a month traveling across West Asia in March, and I went to the areas of the region where there is some form of active resistance to Western hegemony. And one of those areas that I went to was Lebanon. And while I was there, Israel was repeatedly attacking civilian targets in South Lebanon. It was killing not only Hezbollah militants, but was killing as well a number of civilians. Dozens and dozens of Lebanese civilians have died since October 7th. And lo and behold, as you mentioned, it then escalated the matter by destroying the consulate of the Iranian, the Islamic Republic of Iran in Damascus, in flagrant violation of Article 22 of the Vienna Convention, which declares diplomatic missions to be inviolable. That's the word that it uses. Mm-hmm. And it killed something like 16 people, many of them senior officials, but not all of them. There were civilians who were killed as well in that strike. At that point, the Iranian, whatever you may think of Iran's government, it had really no alternative but to strike back. It couldn't allow its diplomatic missions to be destroyed with impunity.
Yes.
And I'm sure that the Israelis understood this. They understood that there was going to be a substantial retaliation and that this would set the stage potentially for the entry of the United States into a full-blown war against Iran. And I think it's quite clear that that was the objective. To date, the Israeli government has not succeeded in drawing the United States into a full-blown war with Iran. But that's the other thing that's at stake here. If we allow the Israeli government to continue to do these things with impunity, there will be a full-blown war with Iran.
Yes.
And that's going to be devastating to the global economy because this is going to cause utter havoc in global oil markets. And whatever those of us who are, concerned about the climate crisis may feel, the fact is that at this particular point in time, the global economy remains critically dependent upon fossil fuels. So if people want to avoid a global depression, they should be very concerned about the escalation of the conflict between Iran and Israel.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is also this, I last week on this show, we spoke about there's this strange rogue mentality of the Israeli leaders. I remarked on the fact, and I think it's still true, they have yet to actually acknowledge that they did make the attack on the Islamic Republic. They didn't, their military nor the political leaders have not said they did it, but they let the world, we all know they did whatever it was. But what a peculiar thing. It's a country that can't even stand up behind its own actions on an international stage.
And even more ridiculous is that Western governments have all acknowledged that Israel did it. And by the way, it has adopted the same subterfuge with respect to the supposed retaliation that Israel is said to have undertaken against Iran after Iran struck Israel with its missiles and drones. It has not taken credit for this kind of farcical attack, which the Americans say Israel orchestrated. Mm-hmm. And we should ask ourselves, what does this say about the balance of power in West Asia? Iran is not hiding the fact that it struck Israel with some 300 missiles and drones. It has openly declared that. And I think people, the adversaries of Israel in the region, are looking at this and saying, they're looking at what Iran did and Iran openly declaring that it did it. And Israel's reluctant to acknowledge what its own partners are saying. And they're I think their interpretation of this is that this shows an unprecedented level of weakness on the part of Israel.
Yes.
You know, so and that's well, going to have
yeah,
massive
when they say that well
the
we
power.
When they say we're a sovereign country and we're a proud people and we stand well, the United States told the world we provided the air cover and UK flew planes out of Cyprus, and so you say, well, no, it turns out they're dependent.
France and Jordan. Correct. And still they managed to strike the Nevatim air base, the Iranians, which arguably, I mean, Scott Ritter has said this, and I have no reason to doubt that what he's saying is true. It is arguably the most defended military asset in the entire world, that air base. So, again, this demonstrated to people in the region that Iran, confronted by the very best air defenses that Israel and its closest allies have to offer, can penetrate Israeli air defenses at will. And, of course, if I were an Israeli official, and thank God I'm not, the thing I'd be most concerned about is not the Nevatim air base, but the Dimona nuclear reactor, which is in fact is very close to the Nevatim air base. If the Iranians can strike that, they can strike Dimona. So there was an interesting comment by apparently a minister in the Israeli government told an Israeli analyst who repeated this to the public, that if Israelis knew what the Mossad was telling the government of Israel in private, millions of them would rush to the Ben-Gurion airport and leave the country. And I think what they're being told is we cannot defend you against Iranian missile attacks.
Yeah, that was the question, again, various journalists posed, which was, they said, well, you talk about there were drones and there were missiles, et cetera. But there was a simple fact that the government of the Islamic Republic said, we hit that base. And I didn't see a rush of reporters to go out and ask, did they hit it? But they did acknowledge later, yes, they did hit it, which means that they achieved their goal.
Correct. And it's not just there are analysts who are saying that based on the evidence, they didn't only hit that base. They also hit another base, an air base nearby. I believe it's called the Rohan military base, and they also are said to have hit, by various analysts, Israel's most important intelligence gathering base in the occupied Golan Heights. So again, this is I think a disastrous development for Israel from the perspective of regional domination. If it had a rational leadership, what it would do at this stage is engage in real diplomacy, negotiation, and compromise, and learn how to coexist peacefully with the other actors in the region. But there's absolutely no indication, Phil, that the Israeli government understands this.
That was what Albert Einstein told them to do from the very beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why he refused to support the state of Israel.
He said, have friendly relations with your neighbors. That's issue number one. And they completely brushed him aside. One last thing, and I do appreciate all this time. This is Dimitri Lascaris. Please follow him on Twitter, by the way. We said something that we probably ought to underline, because it used to be issue number one for all of us, nuclear war. Israel has nuclear weapons, and it's rarely mentioned. That should be put on the agenda, that there should not be any nuclear power in that region.
Absolutely. Not only is it the only nuclear power in the region, it's the only state in the entire region that is not a party to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Yike.
So it's not even subjected to inspection by the International Atomic Energy Association. Again, it doesn't, openly proclaim that it possesses nukes, but all of its allies acknowledge that it does. And I can't think of a government, given its behavior, that is less trustworthy with something as dangerous as a nuclear weapon than the government of Israel.
Why do they use the word strategic? What do they call it? Vagueness?
Ambiguity.
Ambiguity. That's correct, absurd. Yes. If you got them, you have to put it on the record, because we could be targets and they could be targets. Put it on the record.
And my understanding is they won't do that because under U.S. law, The U.S., you know, they're not a party, as I mentioned, to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And under U.S. law, the U.S. would no longer be permitted to provide munitions to Israel. So this is all just a way of evading the United, not just international law, but the domestic laws of the United States. But at the end of the day, you know, what does this cause the Iranians to do? I think it was either a member of the Iranian parliament or a senior military official said a couple of weeks ago, yes, and everybody acknowledges, including the Iranian government, that they are a nuclear threshold state. In other words, they could develop a nuclear weapon quickly if they chose to do that. And he said, you know, if this continues, we may revisit our policy vis-a-vis nuclear weapons. Yes. And even if they don't, Phil, as I said, they can strike the Dimona nuclear reactor. So in a sense, they do have a nuclear weapon. Hmm. If they destroyed, yes, that reactor, this could be devastating for Israel. It's a very small country. And any kind of a major nuclear incident at that reactor could render large swaths of the country uninhabitable.
Wow. Well, I'm really glad I asked. Dmitry, that's a lot of information. We look forward to seeing you back here. We hope you have a safe trip to Gaza in the interim. Thank you very, very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Phil. Always a pleasure.
Okay. Dmitry Lascaris. Please follow him on Twitter and elsewhere.